or if we. What I want to do now.
Did you get one of these yet, James?
Yeah.
Everybody's got one of these, right?
Okay, and this is the primary textbook, remember, is The Universe Next Door, James Sire. So you'll have to pick that up if you don't have it already. Oh, good, good, good.
He said he's got a case of them
somewhere
in his office somewhere.
Okay, so if you don't have one yet, see Dr. Paulson. He's got a whole case of Sire's books. So, what we want to do now is just to defend theism, and more particularly Christian theism, and then we'll go on to, after we defend Christian theism, then we'll go on to deism and naturalism or atheism, basically along the lines that, that Sire does, or at least, you know, in that order, although I'm not really going to stick to the textbook too much on that. Let me just read to you Romans 1, verses 18 to 22. Paul says this, for I consider that the sufferings of this... Oops, wrong chapter. Romans 1, 18 to 22. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened, professing to be wise, they became fools. Paul is saying that even though we don't see the invisible God, we see the visible work of his hands, okay, his creation. So we don't see the Creator, but we see his creation. And through his creation, God proves to us his existence, okay? Paul says that deep down inside, everybody knows that God exists, but we suppress that truth. You cannot suppress a truth that you don't already know, okay? So deep down, I'm not saying an atheist would fail a lie detector test, because the easiest person to lie to is you. You know, when you sin, it comes with a built-in excuse as to why you were justified for what you did, and the only person who's even tempted to believe it is you. Okay, everybody else knows, oh, you're just trying to justify your sinful actions. Okay, so I think we can really fool ourselves and lie to ourselves. But deep down inside, Paul's arguing that God has manifested himself to all mankind through his creation. Okay? Throughout the centuries, Christian thinkers have viewed this passage as well as other passages like Psalm 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Christian thinkers have seen these passages as justification for going to nature and providing evidence for God's existence. Okay? Romans 2:14 and 15, let me read that. So you can argue from the creation to the Creator. Romans 2:14 and 15. For when Gentiles, that's non-Jews, who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. Okay, Paul's saying that the Gentiles did not have God's laws written on tablets of stone, and they didn't have God's laws written in book form, you know, in scrolls. But he says they still had God's laws written on their hearts. That God creates us with a conscience. Okay? And so here, basically, Paul is saying that our concept of morality, right and wrong, comes from the fact that God created us with a moral conscience. And so many Christian thinkers have used, have argued from moral laws to the existence of the moral lawgiver. So basically what I'm getting at, in the scriptures, you know, the scriptures do not argue to God's existence. The scriptures presuppose the existence of God. At the same time, the scriptures do imply very strongly, in fact, sometimes it's explicitly said, that God has given us evidences of his existence in nature, whether it's the conscience of man or in creation itself. Okay? And so what I'm going to do is just go over a few arguments for God's existence. One of the things I'm opposed to is the idea that we could prove God's existence with logical necessity based on one argument. That, in other words, we could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that God exists with just one argument. The problem is human reason is limited, and because of the fall, human reason is fallible. I mean, even with fallen reason, we add 1 + 1, and sometimes we get it right. We figure out it's 2. But sometimes we use human reason and add 1 + 1 and come up with 3. Okay? So, I'm basically not looking for one airtight argument for God's existence. What I use is what I call a cumulative case. And so far in my debates with some of America's leading atheists, they've never really taken me up on my offer. And I don't know if it just goes over their head or if they're just trying to avoid me. But basically what I argue is that if you just go head-to-head, theism versus atheism, and you look at several significant aspects of human experience, it is more plausible, given those aspects of human experience, it is more plausible than that God exists than it is that he doesn't exist. Okay? Given the existence of the physical universe, given the existence of moral laws, it is more reasonable to conclude that God exists than he doesn't exist. So basically, I just argue that it's more, based on these aspects of human experience, it's more reasonable to be a theist, to believe in the existence of a personal God, than it is to be a non-theist. Now, Michael Martin, what he would do in our debate. And so that's the first chapter, my cumulative case for God's existence. What Michael Martin does, and he says, oh, well, this argument could just as easily prove pantheism as atheism. Then he moves on to some other point. It's like, whoa, hold on here. I even accuse him of, I call it the fallacy of ganging up on the theist or something, where it's like the atheist shows up for a debate, but he's brought his pantheist buddy with him, and his panentheist buddy with him, and his polytheist buddy with him. Now, I'll tell you, the truth can look pretty hard to believe if you bring a whole lot of lies and gang up on the truth. But that's just plain unfair. I think if you just get one worldview, theism, against another worldview, atheism, I think we could see the superiority of the theistic worldview real easy. And we just push aside the atheist and then bring on the polytheist. And after, when we're done with him, we can bring on the pantheist. But if we're all going to gang up on him, okay? No, if we're really going to dialogue, what's your view, your worldview, and what's my worldview, and then let's dialogue. Don't bring in your friends, because if you're an atheist, polytheistic or pantheistic options are not open to you. So, but what they, you know, Michael Martin never even wanted to admit whether he believed in absolute morals or if he rejected them. And so I basically accused him of living in a, it's like a guy who throws rocks at everybody else's house, but never gives anybody his address, doesn't give his address out, because he knows that he lives in a glass house. So the atheist wants to play like the old skeptics, that, oh, I don't have a view to defend. I just reject, you know, your belief. I think there's problems with your belief, but I don't have a view to defend. It's like, whoa, hold on. You're a human being. You have some worldview. Now spit it out. What is it? Come clean here. Come out of the closet. See, it's real convenient for the atheist to pretend that he has no positive view to defend, because then he could spend his whole time pointing out what he thinks are either contradictions in your worldview, or problems with your worldview, or questions that your worldview doesn't answer, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't even apply to him, because he is this totally unbiased guy with no view whatsoever. Now, everybody's got a worldview, and if we pit the worldviews one against the other, I think it becomes superiority. The Christian worldview becomes overwhelmingly evident.
Where does he retain his knowledge? I mean, history? I mean, is it just like he's just like saying, "Okay, I know because."
He's basically, he has a full blown, very biased worldview, but he doesn't like to bring that to the forefront when he's in a debate. Because he wants to put the theist on the defensive, but he doesn't want to have to defend his views. So he'll use an argument against the theist based on the existence of evil, and then he'll turn around and argue against theism based on his view that evil doesn't exist. So, you know, it's kind of like, that's just not fair. That's just straight out not fair.
His basic point then is just, that's what creates his character. Because nothing else does, because he doesn't have a belief in God.
Well, what I'm getting at is,
I'm just trying to see what his thinking.
Yeah, he's got a full-blown worldview. You could read his works, Atheism, a Philosophical Justification, and The Case Against Christianity, and he comes right out and tells you what he believes. But in the debate, he doesn't want to do that. He wants to keep the focus on the Christian worldview. And I tell you, you can make Christianity, you can come up with questions that the Bible does not answer, and that human reason isn't able to answer. And it can make, if that's all you focus on, it can make theism look like, whoa, maybe theism isn't the answer. But then when you take those same questions and apply them to other worldviews, and then you look at the answers that theism does answer, which they don't, then you see, okay, well, theism is the true view. But the fact of the matter is, we're fallen and we're limited and we don't have all the answers.
What's an example of something
that the Bible says? It's not that the Bible can't answer, but the Bible hasn't answered. Like, for instance, the problem of evil. We can talk a lot about possible solutions to the problem of evil, but God hasn't given us every specific reason for every specific case of innocent human suffering. So a pastor cannot walk up to a young couple in his church whose one-year-old baby died of a mysterious disease. He can't walk up to them unless God has revealed it to him somehow, I don't know, and say, I know exactly why God allowed your innocent baby to die. But what we can do is say, just like Job, see, in the book of Job's friends were like Helton Walters, saying, look, Job, you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. God only allows evil people to suffer. Job's saying, look, I didn't do anything to bring this on myself. God must keep bad records. I want to plead my case before God. So he had the same health and wealth heretical assumption that they had. So he wanted to plead his case before God to show, hey, look, God, you're punishing the wrong guy. So God arrives on the scene. He doesn't even answer Job. He arrives on the scene, he says, Job, where were you when I created Behemoth? Where were you when I created Leviathan? You guys can't control those beasts. Where were you when I created them? Where were you when I created the universe? And then he basically says, okay, Job, now offer a sacrifice for your friends, because I am really ticked off at them. Okay, so does God answer? You know, it's the problem. How could God allow innocent people to suffer? God never answers that question. Instead, God says, look, Job, you know enough about my goodness not to question me in areas where you just don't understand. And so basically what I argue is that because God has answered 95% of the big questions that human beings ask, why should we give in to the atheist who wants us to reject God? Because God has chosen to refrain from answering the 5% of those big questions. Why should we then reject theism, the belief in a personal God, when all the other worldviews have a problem answering any of the questions? For instance, on the problem of evil, do we have all the answers? No, we don't have all the answers. But at least we can call evil evil. You reject the existence of a personal God when the atheist is talking about this guy dying of an incurable disease and it's a product of evil and all that. He's only using it evil hypothetically. If Christianity is true, that would be called evil. But in the atheistic worldview, all these examples of evil the guy brings up, the atheist doesn't want to let you know, oh, by the way, if my atheism is true, those things aren't really evil. The Holocaust isn't even evil. Just the fact that the theist can call the Holocaust evil and the atheist and the pantheist can't, that's reason for me to become a theist right there alone. Now, but, you know, the thing is, number one, God hasn't given us all the answers. But number two, even if he did, we wouldn't be able to handle it anyway. We wouldn't be able to understand what the heck he's talking about anyway, so...
I give you a little insight to not believe in God, be an atheist, whichever one of those things. Here's why. I mean, my sister was going to church for 3 years, and I was like, that's great. So, it didn't matter. Eternity wasn't thought. Just to go into the mind of an atheist or someone that doesn't believe in God or doesn't believe that God is the way that we believe, it's just amazing because it's so simple.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's different. Some atheists or even just non-Christians at times that are hedonists that just all I care about is having fun, and it might be illicit promiscuity, horrible stuff, or it might be I like donuts and coffee, and so that's your hedonism. You know, I live for donuts and coffee. I don't need to ask. I don't need to. What's that? I don't need to ask any more profound questions than where is the closest Dunkin' Donuts or the closest Starbucks. So there's some people that are just caught into just enjoying, you know. And Blaise Pascal, boy, he's got, Pascal, he's got, has anybody here read his Pensées? Just a dynamite work. But Pascal argues that you got a bunch of human beings lined up, and they're on death row, and each one's being slaughtered, each one in his turn. And you know your number's coming up. And then he says, this is the human condition. In other words, we all come into life knowing that we're going to die. Okay? So that the human condition is death. That we all know we're going to die. But then Pascal argues, we all know we're going to die, so what do we do about it? We go dancing. And Pascal calls that diversions. Rather than wallow in despair, to sum up Pascal, I use a lot of D's. Rather than wallowing in despair, facing reality head on, that we know we're going to die, most people choose to divert their attention, whether it's donuts and coffee, or dancing, or music, or sexual immorality, whatever it may be, anything. You know, Pascal says we're running towards the edge of a cliff, and we hold our hands over our eyes before we get there. It's Ponce's, P-E-N-S-E-E-S. It means thoughts. He was writing a book to defend the Christian faith, and then he died at the age of 39. And so all they had was his notes, and they just put them all together, so nobody knows the exact order. I wrote a book, No Other Gods, A Defense of Biblical Christianity, and I wrote one of the... it's out of print right now, but it's going to be back in print probably in mid-September, and I have a chapter of... when you have all you have is a guy's notes and one-liners, nobody knows exactly how he's arguing his case, and so I give my particular perspective on Pascal in a chapter on his apologetic methodology. But so you get a lot of people who just get caught up in diversions, and for some people that diversion is living for pleasure. For other people that diversion is a fire-breathing atheism where they devote their lives to trying to destroy people's belief in God. And they travel the nation. You know, right? So I got invited to Paul Kurtz's organization to debate an up-and-coming atheist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill campus. And it was probably the biggest atheist conference since 1973, the signing of the second Humanist Manifesto, because there they signed Paul Kurtz's Humanist Manifesto 2000, and so I was looking at a crowd of over 200 of some of the world's leading atheists, professors, scientists, philosophers, from all over the world, and I basically said, if atheism is true, it doesn't make any sense that you guys would travel halfway around the globe to gather around that idea. If God exists, it makes sense that I would put Jesus bumper stickers all over my car. I'm just living consistently with my worldview. I just can't keep it in. I can't wait. I hate to go to bed at night because I can't wait to get up in the morning and to serve Jesus. That makes sense. But I said, what the Apostle Paul said is, you know, if the dead are not raised, if God doesn't exist, and let us eat and drink for tomorrow we die. It makes no sense that you people even showed up for this. Right after I got the words out of my mouth, I thought, oh man, I'm talking to them like they're a bunch of third graders. I gotta keep my mouth shut. I shut up, and you could just feel. I mean, the silence was like deafening. It was so loud. I mean, it was just like, and instead of being heckled, there was like a lot of soul searching and stuff, and it really, really shocked me. But you know, a lot of scientists or atheists, I mean, they just spend their time studying rocks, and it becomes their diversion. And they never even realize that why study rocks for 70 years if you're going to cease to exist after that 70 years is up? Whatever the case, let's take a look at some of these different arguments.
Yeah, good question.
Sure.
Is this Pascal guy the same guy that mentioned the theory of hydraulics?
Theory of hydraulics? He may have. He was a scientist. He was an expert in geometry. He came up with the laws of probability, which is going to be important for us, too. And he basically, the calculator came from his thinking, and even the computer you could trace back to him. Pascal was one of the greatest scientists who ever lived, and he was a fire-breathing Christian. It's really, when we get to Pascal's wager, Pascal was not a betting man, but he was probably the foremost expert in the history of mankind on what a good bet was, because he's the one who wrote the laws of probability. And his argument is that the wise man will always wager on God. And we'll talk about that. What's that? Well, have you ever seen a picture of Pascal? He's a sickly-looking dude. You look at his picture, you find out he died at age 39, you think, Yeah. And then he's got one line in there. He invented all this stuff. He's got one line in there that man spends half his time asleep. I'm like, half his time asleep? If I get 4 hours of sleep, I'm a happy camper. How can half his hour? So I don't know if back then, just because it got dark out and it got old reading by candlelight, if they actually slept for 12 hours, or maybe Pascal himself was just so sickly that he slept for 12 hours. I don't know. But
well, he's the same guy that invented the theory of hydraulics
and he was drunk. No, that wasn't Pascal. Pascal wasn't a drunk. So I did. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen. I saw the name of the guy who invented the theory of hydraulics. Who was it? I don't remember his name, but it wasn't Pascal.
Well, that name is Pascal. I just don't know.
Oh, then it's maybe a different. Yeah, Pascal wasn't a drunk. He wasn't a partier. If anything else, he went too far in the other direction. He was Roman Catholic. He was Roman Catholic, though he sided with the Jansenists, who were basically Calvinists, who were Roman Catholics, and. But he did weird things like took hair and tightened it around his stomach so he could hardly breathe, you know, and stuff to try to do penance and stuff like that. So he wasn't a hedonist. He was the exact opposite.
Louis Pasteur?
No, that's Louis Pasteur.
Pasteur.
Yeah, Blaise Pascal.
Blaise.
Yeah. And it would have been interesting to see what kind of thought he would have come up with if he lived to be 80. Okay, cosmological argument. All you have to write down there is that the universe had a beginning and needs a cause. The universe had a beginning and needs a cause. The scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is twofold. The second law of thermodynamics, which is also called entropy or energy deterioration, tells us that in a closed system, you know, if we close the doors and there was like no air coming into this room and there was no energy coming, then we would make this, if we sealed it, okay, it would make this room a closed system. Well, atheists have to refer to the universe as a closed system because they don't believe in anything outside that system. But basically, it's the idea that in a closed system, the energy will eventually reach a state of equilibrium. All the usable energy in a closed system will eventually be used up. Okay? I mean, you can only completely use the energy from a log, you know, set it on fire and use it to get heat. Once the log has been totally reduced to ashes, you can't do it again. The energy has been used up. First law of thermodynamics tells us the amount of energy in a closed system remains the same. And the universe, it can be viewed as a closed system and to the degree by scientists to the degree that there's no new energy being created nor energy being destroyed in the universe. The amount of energy remains constant. The second law of thermodynamics says even though it remains constant, energy changes forms. And when it changes forms, the usable energy is being used up. So that eventually, given enough time in the future, if there's no intervention from outside the universe, you know, i.e. there's no God, eventually the universe will end. All the energy in the universe will have been used up. But that means that if you go backwards in time, eventually you reach a point where all the energy in the universe was in a usable form. And that would mark the beginning of the universe. So if the universe is going to have an end, it had to have a beginning. If the universe is winding down, it had to be wound up. And so based on the second law of thermodynamics, it shows us that the universe had a beginning. The Big Bang model, most cosmologists today and astrophysicists hold to the Big Bang model. It appears that the universe is expanding as we move forward in time in all different directions. But that means if you go backwards in time, the universe will become more and more dense, more and more compact. until eventually you reach a point that scientists call a point of infinite density or a point of dimensionless space. Now keep in mind, we're talking about the physical universe, okay? So if you have a point of infinite density, a physical point of infinite density, that would be a physical point that is dense or small or compact without limit. Well, guess what? A physical thing can only be finitely dense. It can't be infinitely small or infinitely dense, because then it's small without limit. There's nothing there. Okay? That's the same for a point in dimensionless space. If the whole universe was a point in dimensionless space, it would be a point that takes up no dimensions in space. In other words, a point that takes up no space. Well, there is no such thing as a physical point that takes up no dimensions in space. Again, scientists use all that fancy talk because they don't want to say the Big Bang shows that if you go far enough back in time, the universe just wasn't there. And then all of a sudden, boom, the universe exploded into existence. So, whether you use the Big Bang model or second law of thermodynamics, and there's alternatives to the Big Bang model, but you have very few adherents of them because the evidence against them is so strong. Well, like the oscillating model used to say, well, maybe as the universe is expanding, eventually gravity will pull it back and there'll be another Big Bang. Maybe there's been an infinite number of Big Bangs in the past and an infinite number of Big Bangs in the future. Three problems with that. Number one, the universe is not at the right level of density for gravity to be able to pull back the expansion of the universe, for gravity to collapse the expansion of the universe. So that's number one. The universe is not the right density for that to occur. But even if you assumed, okay, well, let's just assume that somehow it's going to occur even though it's not at the right density. Well, then number two, there's no known, in fact, it goes against all the known laws of physics. If there was a collapse of the universe, for there to be a reversal of the collapse to produce another Big Bang. Okay? So that goes against the laws of physics that would occur. But number three, even if you assume those first two things did occur or can occur, which goes against all the scientific knowledge that we have right now, even if there was going to be another Big Bang, this future Big Bang, as well as past Big Bangs, would still be subject to the law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, which means it would eventually run out of energy, so eventually there would be a final Big Bang that wouldn't collapse. So even if there were multiple Big Bangs, which all the scientific evidence is against it, you still would have to have a first Big Bang, so you would still need, still have the beginning of the universe. Basically, the steady state model was an attempt to get around the second law of thermodynamics and the Big Bang, for that matter. Where as the galaxies like move apart, new energy is created. It just comes into existence on its own, pops into existence on its own. But all the number one is unbelievable. Just in that state, unless you have a creator who keeps creating. But number two, all the scientific evidence is against that as well. So it's pretty well acknowledged. The first and second law of thermodynamics are about as close to a scientific fact as you can get, and they're pretty much, you know, scientists are spending most of their time looking for a loophole to it because they want to escape the theistic consequence of a dying universe, but it's just not there. But whatever the case, the scientific evidence points to the beginning of the universe. Well, whatever has a beginning needs a cause. Okay? Because it couldn't cause its own beginning because then it would have to pre-exist its own existence in order to bring its own existence about. That's ludicrous. So whatever has a beginning, you know, non-being cannot cause being. Nothing cannot cause something. You know, nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. So something had a beginning, something else had to bring it into existence. Okay? By the way, there's also philosophical ways to argue for the beginning of the universe, even apart from scientific ways. For instance, if the universe is eternal, that would mean that there's an unlimited number of moments in the past. Okay? Problem is, you can never traverse an actual infinite number of moments. You can't traverse, you can't cross an actual infinite set of things. It's impossible. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Zeno's paradoxes. He said you couldn't get from point A, that wall, to point B, that wall, because to get from point A to point B, first you'd have to get to the midpoint. However, before you get to that midpoint, you got to get to the midpoint between A and the midpoint. And before you get to that midpoint, you'd have to get to another, and on. So he argued that movement is impossible. Now, the problem that Zeno had was he believed he didn't draw a distinction between the potential realm and the actual realm, like Aristotle did and Aquinas did. There's a potential infinite set of points between point A and point B, but that doesn't mean there's an actually infinite set of points between point A and point B. In other words, if you take something actual like a pen, you can only put side by side a finite number of them between point A and point B. So movement is not impossible. Okay. But the kernel of truth, and what Zeno was arguing, was that you cannot traverse an actual infinite set of points. So if there was an infinite number of moments in the past, you would never reach the present moment now. Because no matter how many moments you traversed, there'd still be an infinite number of moments more. Now, since we have reached the present moment now, that tells us there's only a finite number of moments in the past. There had to be a first moment. In other words, God exists in eternity outside of time, and God created time when he created the first changing beings. Okay? Once beings were created that didn't exist, and all of a sudden now they do exist, that's when time began. Okay? Before that, God existed in the eternal now. So there's another argument way to argue that there had to be a first moment, there had to be a beginning. So whatever has a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. For the continuing existence, yeah. First and second laws of thermodynamics? I know there is a third law, and I haven't really done... For apologetics is kind of my main field, and I've heard that there is a third law, but I haven't. Do you know what it is?
My brother-in-law basically is calling apologetics on it. You guys sound similar, but he's using the
third law. And I read about the third law, but I didn't.
It's about mutations, where you leave something alone on the track of the food.
Sounds like it's kind of an offshoot of the second law, which the second law is an offshoot of the first law, because the second law is energy deterioration. And it sounds like it would imply that things left to themselves can go from order to chaos but things left in themselves will not go from chaos to order. And the interesting thing, though, is you can argue that from the second law itself. So the third law might be a specific aspect of a specific application of the second law, which your brother-in-law is getting a lot of mileage out of. But if you can get, if you can write it down for me, talk to him, write it down for me, and that would help a lot. Someday I hope Cascade, for some reason Cascade has me year after year come in and teach a course on worldviews. And they never have me teach, like, you know, intro to philosophy or philosophy of religion or apologetics or ethics and that type of thing. But you know, I'd love to do it, and I'm usually considered the go-to guy in Western Washington when it comes to Christian apologetics, but I'd love to teach you a course in apologetics for them. But whatever the case, scientific, you know, the creation versus evolution, some we're not going to be able to get too deeply into. In fact, we might not be able to get into it at all, but there's a wealth of information there as well. Okay, for the continuing existence of the universe, just put that the existence of dependent beings, necessitates the existence of a totally independent being. The existence of dependent beings necessitates the existence of a totally independent being. So if the universe is nothing but a collection of dependent beings, okay, then there's no ground for its existence unless a totally independent being that exists in its own power is there to ground it in existence. Okay? All these things that are on this table, the bottles, the tape recorder, the sets of papers, they are hovering above the ground, okay? So they are dependent upon something to hold them up, okay? And lo and behold, they're dependent upon this table, which has the structure and the legs to suspend itself and things that are placed upon it to suspend them above the air. So it's like, if all you have are just things on this table, you know, well, we could do this. Well, how is this bottle able to be hovering, you know, maybe 3 feet or 2.5 feet off the ground? And somebody could say, well, that's easy. It's been placed upon. It's standing upon that audio cassette. Yeah, but how do we explain the audio cassette, though, hovering 2.5 feet off the ground? Oh, well, that's easy because it's been placed upon the sheet of paper. Yeah, but that's still, you know, it still hasn't answered the question. How do we explain the sheet of paper that's hovering 2.5 feet off the ground? Well, eventually you get to something that contains the explanation, and that is that this table is structured in a way so that it stands 2.5 feet off the ground because its legs go down and support it and go right down to the ground. Okay? And so basically, when you're looking at things that are dependent on other things for their existence, eventually you got to arrive at the table. God, a totally independent being, that grounds the existence of all dependent beings. Okay, the teleological argument. This is the argument that the design of the universe needs an intelligent designer. The design in the universe needs an intelligent designer. You can look small, or you can look big, If you're seeking God, if you're open to God, you'll find Him. What I mean by if you look big, the whole universe, it's a chemical composition of the opposite end of the universe, which is just slightly different. There would be no life on planet Earth right now. You come to our solar system, if the sun was a little bit closer to Earth, there'd be no life. We'd all fry. If it was a little bit further away from the Earth, we would all freeze to death. Okay? Scientists call this the anthropic principle, from the Greek word anthropos, for man. And what the anthropic principle says is that it seems like the whole universe was designed to support life on the planet Earth. Now, my conclusion from that is, well, that's because it is. Their conclusion is, that's rather strange. Now let's try to explain why it is that way. And they come up with all weird, wild theories, different anthropic principles, to try to explain why it appears like the whole universe was designed to sustain human life on planet Earth, when we scientists know that's not the case. What do you mean? You know, I mean, you're saying all the evidence, all the scientific evidence points in the direction of theism, but we know that's not true. So now let's